Hi, Shabbat Shalom. It's Rabbi Jim Egolf. Thank you so much for tuning in this week to my podcast. So this week is a special Shabbat. It's Vayikra, and it's Shabbat Zachor. Shabbat Zachor means the Shabbat of remembrance, and Shabbat Vayikra means the first Shabbat that we're reading the book of Leviticus for this year. So we're going to take a little bit of a look into that Shabbat Zachor, which is all about the Shabbat of memory, and talk about the memories that we're supposed to hold and how we care for them, and do some remembering of some really bad guys. Again, I thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I hope you have a wonderful and blessed week. Shavua Tov. There is a story told about the former Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes that once he was on a train going someplace, and the conductor came up and asked him for his ticket. Justice Holmes searched through his coat pockets and then his vest pockets, unable to find the ticket. And the young man taking the ticket taker turned to him and said, "Justice Holmes, I'm sure that the Great Pennsylvania Railroad will just, you can mail their ticket in at some point." The justice looked up at the young man and said, "Son, it's not a question of where my ticket is. The question is, where am I going?" So we come to Shabbat Zachor, and we are given this difficulty of the value of memory. As Jews, we are given two mitzvot that are somewhat difficult to reconcile. The first is that we tend to be a people whose identity and character is built on memory. This is reflected in this week's holiday and the Torah portion for tonight. This being not just the Shabbat of Vayikra, the beginning of the book of Leviticus, but also the Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat of remembrance. One of the reasons that it is important to have two scrolls in an ark is because of Shabbatot like this one, where we read from two totally different parts of the Torah. Tonight, I read the Maftir for this Shabbat, Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 19, even though we're in the book of Leviticus. We are told this evening to remember Amalek, who attacked Israel at the rear in a cowardly and unprovoked offensive, since Israel, according to the commentators, was not any threat to Amalek. Some even suggest that the Amalekites were not after Israel, but rather they really wished to assault God. Since this time, it has become common to blot out the name of Amalek from under the heavens. In fact, when mentioning someone with a particularly less than desirable character, it is common after one recites their name to say Yamak Shemo, literally, "May his name be blotted out." So we're supposed to remember Amalek so we can blot out his name. Seems kind of, well, circular at best, since we're supposed to remember it to be rid of it. It seems like we put out food to attract the ants in order to spray them with bug killer, but anyway, it is the mitzvah we have, and we're supposed to perform it at least once a year. Of course, then you might ask, well, what does Amalek have to do with Purim? Okay, you got to stay with me here. So here we go. Amalek does their dastardly deeds in the Torah, which is where we derive the mitzvah to blot out their name. Then, a couple of books later, and a few hundred years go by, when we come to the book of Samuel. There we read how King Saul, who is from the tribe of Benjamin, is ordered to kill all the Amalekites in Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 2 through 34. And this story is the Haftarah for this special Shabbat Zachor. King Saul is given the mitzvah by the prophet Samuel to slaughter all the Amalekites and take nothing, not even the spoils of war. King Saul, whose incompetence leads to David being made the king later, well, he gets a little greedy and he saves the king of the Amalekites and he brings the best of the spoils home with him. The prophet Samuel is outraged by King Saul's disobedience, and Samuel runs the king of the Amalekites through with a sword. That king's name was Agag. Saul, Benjaminite. Agag, king of the Amalekites. Saul, incompetent king. Got that? Fast forward. The beginning of the book of Esther tells us Mordechai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Haman is an Agagite. That is, he is a descendant of the royal family of the Amalekites. And the story of Purim is how Mordechai is able to redeem his incompetent kingly ancestor by doing in the presumably last of the Amalekites, hence the Hebrew Bible's idea of poetic and possibly prophetic justice. Still, we are left with the command that Samuel gave to Saul, derived from the Torah, to blot out the name of Amalek. Funny thing about Amalek, now there's the beginning of a sentence you don't hear every day. Funny thing about Amalek is that much of our language and culture today is not couched in the spirit of the disputes of the Talmud or even those of the Hebrew Bible. Rather, we are often led and told to believe and to treat every opponent as if they are Amalek everywhere. Regardless of how paranoid we might be regarding Amalek, let's be clear. When we begin to see Amalek everywhere, we just might be deluding ourselves. Now first, I want to listen to one of the moral voices of our day, Elie Wiesel. Wiesel wrote in the Jerusalem Post that we must not allow the hater to define us. And he wrote this at the height of the last Intifada in Israel, back when suicide bombers were attacking on a daily basis within the Green Line, that would be the area of Israel proper. In truth, this is one of the challenges in dealing with Amalek or a Haman. How do we maintain and respond in a meaningful fashion, while at the same time not lowering ourselves to the currency of the evil other in the dispute? We have been in and are currently in a situation where there are several people who, as opposed to being Amalek, are treated as if they have to prove that they are not Amalek in order to be considered acceptable. Think of Muslims in our country today, and especially after 9/11. Many of them immigrants who came to our country to escape persecution, and then ironically, it was in this country, with its promise of freedom, where they found new persecution. In fact, after 9/11, even in my synagogue at that time, we had a problem. It was not that we had like lots of Muslims who came to services, but we were in that category of being other in a small Jewish community in the Deep South. Yes, we were supposedly in the 21st century, but that might not be enough to protect us from ignorance and hatred. If someone decided to go and attack the houses of worship that didn't have crosses outside, when we decide to attack the hater, regardless of who they are, with their weapons of hate, then we have given them two things. We have offered them the power of defining the terms of the dispute, and in their minds, we've also made them right. If we meet violence, shall we say, with violence, then we have begun to trade in their currency. Secondly, and this is most troubling, we make them right. For in their minds, they can say to themselves, see, if we, terrorists, hadn't acted first, they would have done this anyway, since they have shown themselves capable of doing this now. I didn't promise you that you would feel better. I just wanted to point out that people willing to engage in violence are often driven by a certain circular logic. Speaking of being in the loop, and this brings me back to the story of this week of Purim, one of the most difficult yet literary perfect pieces of the Purim story, is that the nooses and gallows built by Haman are actually his end. As my friend Mark Klein, Rabbi Mark Klein, loves to joke, Haman's favorite phrase is, "No nooses, good news." But I digress. It is hard to teach not to meet violence with violence when it is written into the Purim story. And let's be clear. On the one hand, there is an absolute right to self-defense in the Torah and in Jewish literature. And on the other hand, that defense cannot become offense to the point where we allow a hater or an enemy to define the response by their attack. When we do, and this is pointed out in the literary construct of the Book of Esther, there is little difference between Mordechai and Haman in terms of how they treat their enemies. Granted, Haman had a certain pedigree that forced Mordechai's hand, yet this should also be a caution to us. Speaking of cautions, look at our world today. Whether it be politics, wars, economics, social issues, I fear that we are often a little too ready to see and treat others like Amalek. If we want to attack, it is so much easier if we feel or can convince ourselves that we were just about to be attacked. Remember, Amalek can't be everywhere. Otherwise, we really are surrounded by our enemies. And secondly, if we constantly return to this remembrance all the time, we should pause and wonder whether or not it is Amalek or we who have issues that need to be addressed. In a midrash called Yalchut Shemoni, the text tells us something about that ancestor of Haman, Agag, that seems to answer the question, why did God allow Haman to be born? The answer goes that God brought Haman into the world only as a reward to Agag, who, while in prison, wept and grieved that his offspring would be lost from the world. Even the most malevolent and vicious enemy we might have could do something redemptive in God's eyes. The rabbis continue this in the sense that some argue that the mitzvah to kill Amalek does not apply until we've done our obligation as Jews to turn Amalek from his evil ways and bring him to some repentance, an act of repair of his actions. So according to the rabbis, if we find Joe Amalek in our synagogue, we cannot assume that he is bad and run him through. We have to remember what Amalek did, and we must remember the struggle, lessons, possibilities, and responsibilities we have in facing any foe. Chances are, no matter how bad we think that person or foe is, they aren't Amalek. Shabbat Shalom. Music you hear on this podcast is available from Magnatune.com.